Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next-to-listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. You have to wrestle with this. It would be wonderful if history was a pleasant picture to look at. Sadly, it is not. Not today. It wasn't to the people of history either. Take Marcus Aurelius. When he was made emperor, he could not have helped but look back at his predecessors, most of whom had not stood up well to the duties of the office. It would have been nice to simply enjoy the pomp and glamour and traditions of the office, but to do that would have been to ignore its darker sides too. For instance, at an early age, Marcus Aurelius was introduced to the inspiring examples of Cato, Thrasea, Helvidius, the Stoics whose lives instructed him in the importance of equality under the law, freedom of speech, and respecting individual rights. Yet it could not have escaped him that it was the emperors of the past who had brutally persecuted and taken the lives of those brave heroes, the people who had the same job that he now had. It would have been easier not to think about this, but he had to, lest he want to repeat the mistakes of the past, lest he want to commit injustices himself. So Marcus wrestled with this. He looked uncomfortable truth in the face and tried to be made better for it. Was he perfect at this? No, of course not. Sadly, the persecution of Justin Martyr and other Christians under Marcus Aurelius was all too similar to the persecution of the Stoics under Nero. But he tried. He moved the ball forward, if only a little. Today, we must do the same. Whatever country we live in, whatever party we belong to, whatever generation we belong to, are you, as an American, able to really sit back and think about what it has been like for Black people in this country? Not just during slavery, but much more recently? Are you familiar with the history of redlining, lynching, poll taxes, Confederate statues, and police brutality? Have you, as a German, really studied the Holocaust? Or as a British or French person, do you understand the viciousness of colonialism? As a Turk, have you honestly looked at the Armenian genocide? As a Chinese or Russian citizen, can you wrap your head around the extent of the enormous human suffering and loss during your revolutions in the 20th century? Horrible things have been done by good people. Horrible things that are still happening, and the legacy of these things is still very much alive. It's not just race or nationality either. Doctors need to wrestle with the opioid crisis, the church with homophobia and abuse scandals. Former bullies need to wrestle with their schoolyard behavior, football with concussions and player safety, academics with their support of left-wing dictators, Hollywood with the blacklists, parents with the mistakes they made with their own children, and on and on and on. We do this not to whip ourselves. Of course, the Stoics know you cannot change the past, but you can learn from it. You can end what has gone on too long. You can make amends. You can help us get a little bit closer to a more just society. We can't ever be perfect, Epictetus said, but we can strive to be better, which is why we must wrestle with the past every single day. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I think you can tell a lot about a person by how they treat someone who can't really do anything for them, or, you know, sort of how they behave in private. And when my books were first starting to take off in professional sports, I got this text and a call sort of out of the blue from Dr. Michael Gervais, who is one of the most elite sports performance psychologists in the world. He's worked with the Seattle Seahawks and Microsoft. He's been featured everywhere you can imagine. He reached out to me and he just offered some advice, and he gave me a bunch of great advice, and he really encouraged me. And it was a super important and formative conversation that I continue to reap benefits from to this day. And I ended up coming out and meeting some folks at the Seahawks. I went out and did his podcast several years ago. It was an illustrative moment. And so I'm really excited to talk to Michael Gervais today. I actually have been listening to his podcast for a long time. Shaka Smart told me about it. Everyone knows Michael Gervais, the influencer of the influencers as far as people doing great things in sports and business and music and life. I texted Camila Cabello before I got on with him and said I was going to talk to him, and she was very excited. I talked to Rich Roll, another guy who loves him. You know, Michael is legit. You're going to learn a lot in this interview. And then actually tomorrow, the day after I'm recording this, I'm going back on his podcast again. So if you want a longer conversation, or you want more him asking me questions, you can listen to that. And I did an interview with him several years ago, as I was saying, that's like 3 hours long, which I think you might like. You can listen to the Finding Mastery podcast, which is a great look into Michael's mind. And you can check out his Audible original, which he wrote with Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll, Compete to Create an Approach to Living and Leading Authentically. A great dude, a great book. Check this out and enjoy. So I was curious about your story, because how does one become a performance psychologist? Because I wasn't even aware that was a thing that existed until not that long ago. And I'm not sure. I think that it's becoming more popular, and obviously you have a big platform, but I've got to imagine your average person, when they think, you know, Tom Brady or Russell Wilson, they're not, or baseball, they don't think like, oh, this is where the real competition is these days. Like, this is where the real training is being done.
Yeah. So is the question like about training, or is the question about like,
how did you get into it? I'm curious, like, how you even gravitated towards that as a profession.
So it started, like, my awareness started when I was 15 years old, and there's two types of surfing. I grew up surfing. One was free surfing, one was competitive surfing. And I just couldn't put it together when the competition was on. And so in free surfing, I had great command. Like, I loved what the way it felt to be out there and do my thing and be creative. And then as soon as people were judging and watching and scoring, and I just became, I don't know, 50% of myself, something like that. And so I was in a heat, perfect conditions, super glassy. It's about head high, which is just kind of really fun, great conditions. And there's only three people out in the water. And normally there's like 30, let's say. And it's highly competitive, even in free surfing, to get the wave. But it's more like an aggressiveness meets positioning. And so come competition day, there was a gentleman that I was surfing with all the time. He was like 20 something, I was 15, and he paddles by me and he goes, Gervais, I see you out here every week. And you got to stop during these competitions. You just got to stop thinking about what could go wrong. And I was like, how the hell, how did he know? And then come to find out there's this thing called psychology. And so eventually just took me down that path. And so that's how it started. But psychology, undergrad was general psych, master's degree was in sports and performance, I'm sorry, sport and exercise science. So kinesiology based, and then PhD in psychology with an emphasis in sport and performance.
Yeah, actually, now that you say this, it strikes me that performance psychologists have always existed. They were just previously known as older players. Like that's where the wisdom was, or managers or coaches, right? It's only as sports has professionalized that became a specialty, its own domain that there were experts in. But the idea of like, oh, I see exactly what you're doing and I've done that myself, or that this is a very common thing that we see rookies doing every single year. I mean, that's as old as probably the Greek Olympics.
When you think about who influences the psychology of people, it tends to be people that are influential in our lives. That doesn't mean that they're skilled. It doesn't mean that they're trained. It doesn't mean that they have any command of research or science or evidence or best practices, but they might have an intuition. They might have a way about themselves. They might be on it. They might be absolutely freaking amazing. And so sport and performance psychology is the formal study of the psychology of excellence. How do the extraordinaries, from a research evidence-based standpoint, you know, how do they do it? And the reason we want research and evidence behind it is so that we can stack on it, and we're building from sturdy foundations, internal foundations, rather than, you know, my uncle, he played in the league once and what he did was, well, that's good for your uncle. Maybe it really worked and he was a Hall of Famer, but it doesn't mean it's healthy and it certainly doesn't mean it's sustainable. So yeah, that's kind of, that would be the only slight difference, but your point is well taken, which is, let's call it 60 years ago, which isn't that long ago, great coaches, whether they're in sport, well, let's just stay with sport. Yeah. Great coaches did most of it. They were the chefs. They were the nutritionists. They were the sub parents. They were the technical coaches, physical coaches, mental coaches. And then as disciplines started to get more sophisticated, the progressive coach was like, hey, there's this thing called strength and conditioning as a science.
Right.
Maybe we should bring them in so our athletes will be bigger, faster, stronger in the fourth quarter, end of the game. Sure enough, they were. You know, you apply some good science and stuff happens. But that was like 60 years ago. Now every team has strength and conditioning. But probably the last 10 years ago is when the progressive coaches really started to double down on bringing the science of psychology into the fold.
Yeah, it's interesting to me too. I think sports is probably ahead of the rest of the world on this. And for people who have watched Billions, maybe you see it a little bit in like Wall Street. But like when I've been lucky enough, I know you've done the same thing. When I went to see you at the Seahawks, or when I've been to great college programs, and then, you know, you visit a military base, you're meeting with some people in the special forces, you realize that actually pretty much anywhere that elite performance is happening, they've had to figure out the need to have someone specialize in making their elite performers better at the sort of mental side of the game. And it's weird to me how similar all those domains are, even if in one domain they're hitting a ball with a bat, and in another one they're flying Apache helicopters, and then another, they're trading stocks. The same idea of like getting better at the performance side of things being a priority is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're on that for sure, which is that there are only three things that we can train as humans, and they cut across industries, right? You can train your craft, whatever that might be, to your point, helicopters or throwing footballs or, you know, canvassing, you know, with paint. So you train your craft, train your body, and you can train your mind. And the best of the best are saying, and they've been doing this for a long time, hundreds, thousands of years, saying, I'm not leaving this mental training thing up to chance. You know, it's just that the science is now catching up, let's call it the last, you know, 60 years. And so, you take your mind everywhere you go. How about that? So, you know, if it's a mess, it doesn't matter if you're in the living room or a boardroom. If it's a mess, it sooner or later gets exposed. And that's what happened to me. You know, I didn't have a sturdy framework to understand what it meant to be judged, as opposed to what it meant to use an opportunity to see what I was made of, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah.
I was going to say that situation you described is so timeless and so universal, which is like, I know how to do this very well, and I've practiced it a million times, but where I struggle is under pressure, or where I struggle is in the moment, or where I struggle is, you know, when I had a bad night the night before. Like, how do you do it when it counts? you can see why that matters, whether you're trading stocks, negotiating trade deals for a government or SEAL Team Six.
Yeah. And like your relationship with thinking is born out of philosophy. So you've got, your arms around philosophical positions and ideas and tenets, and psychology and philosophy are intertwined.
Sure.
And so some would suggest that certain branches of psychology are not that different than philosophy. And some of the greats, like the first American psychologist, applied psychologist, William James. I mean, was he a philosopher? I think so.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So are most people philosophers? Yeah. Some are just really sophisticated
right.
and have really, pulled on some threads to get some clarity. But most of us have ideas about ideas and ideas about humans, because we're social beings. And then where the kind of the overlapping begins to be between philosophy and psychology begins to, get onto the edges is what are best practices from a laboratory meets frontier, like there's a frontier in all the domains that you're talking about. Like, where does the laboratory and the frontier, where do those meet? And how do we prepare and condition our minds to be able to execute out there? And sometimes philosophical frameworks are one of the big rocks to get in the container.
Yeah, I would think so.
Like with the Stoics, to your point, sorry to interrupt you, but what's in your control, what's not? Super basic, but powerful framework. And then when we kind of pull on that thread a little bit more, okay, what's in your control is how you speak. Well, let's train how you speak to yourself. Let's train the way that you interpret events. You can train those.
Yeah. And what I think about it too, when I think about, okay, so my background's in philosophy, I've read all this stuff. Well, then why do I have a therapist? Why have I gone to marriage counseling with my wife? Why have I done these things? It's because the broad philosophical concepts can only get you so far. And then you have to work with a specific person who has real training in the human psychology and the interacting with human beings. I think philosophical principles tend to be broad. I don't want to say they're abstract, but they tend to be ideas. And then to me, where a performance psychologist or a psychologist or a therapist of some kind is, that's helping the one-on-one individual apply those ideas to their specific problems, rooted in their understanding of each other as human beings.
Yeah, that's certainly where you go when you go upstream. You go, okay, what are the philosophical principles? Then downstream are what are the psychological skills and tools that you can build as a repertoire so that you can apply the right skill or the right tool in the right way at the right time.
Yes.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that psychologists are working at the individual level only.
Sure.
Because there is scale to do in psychology, but it really is about principles, skills, and tools that you can practice. And psychology is not that different than most other domains in human performance, which is like in the physical training world, there's sets and reps that you do, whether it's mm-hmm. squats or whatever it is. You'll do 6 reps of 4 sets and, call that, part of your workout. The same is true psychologically. There's sets and reps. You do sets and reps in breathing training, sets and reps in confidence training, sets and reps in focus and refocus training. I can get into all that if you want to get into it. But then there's also this other part, which is the self-discovery part, which is like, who are you?
Right.
And this is where it gets really interesting. That's the intersection that you and I play in. What are the big questions in life? And are you grokking with them? What is your purpose? What are you going to do with your money? What does success mean? What is high performance? How do you define high performance? And so, until you get your arms around those things, it stays in the abstract for others. And last part that I want to make on this point, because it's so important, is that let's say you said, philosophy will get you kind of going. Well, if you only have psychological skills and tools, but don't map it to a philosophy or framework, I call it psychological framework. You don't map it into a sturdy framework, which is really, how do you make sense of yourself and the world around you? If you don't map it there, it just becomes like these kind of poorly adhesive band-aids, They're band-aids that they kind of work, but they're not really sticking. Because it's a little bit of a weird analogy, but
I like it.
Is the point.
I think you need both. And then I think where the performance specialist comes in, or the coach, you know, however you want to think about it, is so important. Is like, okay, so I was thinking about this as you were talking. So, you know, Alexander the Great is tutored by Aristotle. And then Alexander the Great goes to conquer the world. Now, he could have taken one of Aristotle's books with him and just read that. But instead, he brings Aristotle with him for a reason, right? Because it's about a dialogue, a discussion. He wants to be able to bring specific problems to this great mind for him to walk him through. And I think about Marcus Aurelius as this advisor named Rusticus. He has a philosophy teacher named Sextus. It's the advisors that he has, the people who understand not just the world, but would then understand him at a level that he probably doesn't even understand himself, that allows him to work through these really difficult problems. And I think that's what you need when the stakes are high. Like, you know, you're throwing, you're in the Super Bowl, or you're running a company. The CEO can't afford to have their emotional issues cloud their judgment, or, you know, and so I think it's really important that you bring someone in for your performance. It's not just for you, but it's not that you're deficient in some way. It's that the process brings out the best version of you.
Mm, there you go. And so that's exactly right. And you know what we've learned? So let's call it, so I've been in sports psychology, performance psychology for 20, 25 years, somewhere in there. And the last 6 years, I've been fortunate enough to partner up and poke my head into enterprise businesses, at Microsoft being one of the most amazing partners that we have. And I was blown away. Ryan, poked my head in there, working with all the way down from the CEO executive team all the way through the organization. And in elite sport, we talk a lot about recovery. Mm-hmm. And we have a performance division that sits inside to help coaches figure out the psychology, their psychology, figure out the right psychology to, and the psychological skills for their athletes. And we talk about recovery a lot. And the reason I'm bringing up recovery is because in business, one, they don't have that customized partnered approach for training of the mind. They have mentors for training of craft, other CEOs that are on it or whatever, but training of the mind, they're not quite there yet. And they're certainly not on the conversation of recovery. Sure. And so what we've learned is that recovery is a massive competitive advantage, both for internal thriving, meaning that I'm living my best life because I'm no longer irritated and frustrated and, you know, malaise or fatigue or anxious or whatever, because I've got the right systems in place to recover well and to be my very best, to use your language. And then the other part of it is that when you cascade that throughout the organization, it becomes this massive competitive advantage. And it's radical, because in elite sport, it is square one, like, and it's not there in business yet. So I'm excited to see what happens in business over the next decade.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening. But depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year. So you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Yeah, I think this is what we're talking about, sports being on the cutting edge a little bit. I think sports are more under, it's like the sports know, the owner of a sports team and the coach of a sports team understand, like, these are racehorses. These are like sort of elite racehorses. This is talent. And I think sometimes in the business side of things, you're like, this is labor. Like, these are just people doing a specific thing. This, I think, comes from our industrial understanding of how capitalism works or how business works. You don't think about it as talent. You don't. And what's really, it's weird to think that not that long ago, Silicon Valley was like, hey, if there's ping pong tables and lunch at the building, people will be happier at work and not try to sneak out of work all the time. And who knows, maybe they'll bump into each other in the hallway and have a good idea, and that'll make us $1 billion. Like that, if you want to talk about recent, just how recent that is, as recent as sports. Like the NBA, for instance, is just like, hey, you know, if we limit the amount of back-to-back games that a team plays in the course of a year, the on-court product will be better because the players will have slept more. You know, like, it's weird how recent a lot of this stuff is.
Oh, and the language is really important, because the language that we use is a reflection of our psychology, and it's also informing our psychology. So it's not just one directional. Is that if we don't quite understand the potency of the language that we're using, and I'll give you a handful of things like should or could or I gotta or never and always. Those are all considered cognitive distortions. Mm-hmm. And they end up creating frameworks about how we are thinking. So it's like a bottom-up way of approaching. Top-down. And so to your point is that when we use the word human capital, workforce, labor force, it's almost like it takes the humanity out of it.
Sure.
Where when we talk about athletes and artists, we talk about talent.
We call them,
yeah, right, yeah. The thing they're more aligned to the specialness of the thing that they do. But here's a trap. It's not quite as clean as like equal divide. Here's the trap: is that most highly talented people were talented at a young age. They had some proclivity at a young age. I'm talking more about the sport world than business.
Sure.
But they were talented at a young age. And as a young age, what most people do is that they're supposed to form their identity. But if the identity is almost infused with the thing that you do, then your identity is mapped to your outcomes.
Sure.
And you have this, and it's this really confusing, non-conscious, below conscious surface that I am what I do. And that ends up becoming problematic, because all we're doing is we're saying, oh, the athlete, fill in the blank. And there's so much more than the athlete. So
right.
There's so much more than the star. There's so much more to them. There's a humanity in all things that we do. And I think a big part of my work in high performing environments is to help people. This is like basic one framework: decouple who you are from what you do. And it's so intertwined. That's why the fight, flight, freeze mechanisms are on full tilt for people prior to walking on stage or prior to getting on the mound. Those true brain mechanisms that are responsible for survival are on point when there's nothing of real threat, physical threat. The only thing on threat, whether you're on the mound or on the stage, is other people's opinions. But our ancient brain, as beautiful as it is, hasn't caught up with modern frameworks. So just kind of pulling out identity, what you do, pulling those two things out, is this massive gift to space and creativity and freedom.
But how do you talk to an athlete about not identifying with what you do when you're in an industry that's so cutthroat that if you are not winning, you don't get to do that thing very long?
Oh, most of my environments are exact. Meaning, like, if you, there's a short runway for mistakes because it's also public. And so it's not that you don't identify with what you do, but your identity is not just that. And so when you pull apart what you do from who you are, the work is to say, well, who am I independent of what I do? It's that part of you that's the same as when you're 30, that you were 3 or 13, you know, like, who am I? And then the thing that I do ends up becoming the way I'm expressing my craft and expressing my philosophy and expressing my psychology. And I'm using my body or my canvas, whatever that might be, to do just that. And I'm telling you, it's the bet to lay, because you create space and then you damp down all of the alarm bells in our brain. And let me just kind of do a little nerdy thing here for just a moment, that there is a difference between the brain and the mind. And yes, I'm going to butcher an analogy here just for the sake of simplicity, that the brain is like the hardware in a computer and the mind is like the software that runs the hardware. Now, it doesn't quite hold up when you really pull on the science of it, but it is interesting to think about, like, okay, you were born with some hardware, but who trained, who programmed your software? You know, and for most people, it's like, I don't know, for me, it was the knuckleheads on, you know, when I was in grade school, they like, sure, and then the commercials I was watching and what the stars might say or might not say from sport. Like, and then my, you know, the religious people in my family, and then my parents were doing their best, but it's a junk. It was before I really dove into it, it was a junkyard approach to identity and philosophy and whatever. And so there's a chance now as a informed adult to say, right, I'm going to do that deep work. Who am I?
Right. No, I want to. So two things. So one, I would say, to go back to this identity issue, maybe what you're saying is you identify with what you're doing. Like, let's say it's playing baseball or mm-hmm. trading stocks, but you can't identify as that. So it's with versus as, because it can't it's part of you, but it's not exclusively you. And if it's exclusively you, then you're very vulnerable.
That's right. Because, like, let's say, and I think as a writer, you can relate to this, is that the trap is to say, you know, Ryan, you know, the shortcut, if you will, and there's really, shortcuts are dangerous, so I'll asterisk that. Yeah. Ryan, tell me about yourself. And you go, oh, I'm a writer.
Right.
Oh boy, we're in trouble. Okay, because now, like, it's a shortcut to help people understand what you do,
sure,
but it's not who you are.
Right.
So, like, if we had more time, say, you know, Ryan, how do you describe yourself? And you'd say, well, which part of my life? You know, like, do you want to know my core principles? Well, you know, I've got a lot of roles. I'm a dad and a husband and a.
Right.
But it's underneath the roles, I'm a writer. And underneath the roles, like, this is the essence of who I am. So it's just getting clear that when I write, it's part of what I do.
Right.
It's a reflection of some stuff that I hold underneath the surface. And, but when you're reading my writing, whoever the you is, the other person, you're not, I am free from your evaluation of me, because this is an expression. I'm doing my very best. It's an expression. It's not the totality of me. And that's where
Cheryl,
it gets,
Cheryl Strait has talked about how often people confuse, in my world, writing and publishing. You know, so people, you can identifying as a writer is actually not a big problem, because anyone can be a writer, right? Writing is the doing the thing. The problem is if you identify with being a published author, or if you're identifying with football because football is your life, great. You can, no one can prevent you from having a relationship with football. If your identification is as a professional football player, or as the best running back in football, now you're pretty precarious, because a lot of factors determine how long and if you get to continue to do that thing.
And you're, especially in sport and business or writing, is that there's other people that are going to determine,
yes,
whether you can do the thing or not. And so, yeah. So if you are a person who loves to create and whatever, it's independent. And so if it happens to be football, then it happens to be entrepreneurship, and then it's trading stocks, and then it's being, you know, and there's a progression across life arc, then why? Okay. I had pre-performance anxiety but okay, let's just call it what it is. I had anxiety.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And anxiety is this excessive worry about what could go wrong. But in my life, what I was worried about that could go wrong was really what people are going to think of me. And so when you get down to it, well, no reasonable person goes, I need to be liked by others to be okay. But I'm telling you, it's the default mechanism for most of us. And until you get in there, carve that thing out, it's like fucking hard sledding. It's really hard.
One of my favorite passages in meditations, Marcus, and what I love about meditations is you have the most powerful man in the world writing to himself. And so you get this magnificent glimpse into sort of what's actually running through the head of the most powerful man in the world. And he says, you know, we care about ourselves more than other people, but we care about their opinions more than our own, like about ourselves. And I think that's the same thing. It's like, you know who you are, what you're doing, whether for me, it's writing a book, for an athlete, you know, their ability to do something on the field. And then some sports writer says something negative and all of a sudden they're in their head about it. Or, you know, you see some girl in the crowd you're trying to impress, and now you can't focus on what you have to do. And you have to be able to tune out what other people think about what you're doing, because what you're doing is, quite frankly, hard enough.
And at the same time, be open to hear that information, because the one person in the back of the room that says, I'm not willing to agree to what I just heard you say, might be an unlock for you to go deeper, to expand, to you know, literally unlock a new way of thinking. But if we attach it to our ego and our identity, the classic psychological response is defensiveness. So, and this is actually, you know, the predictions for divorce, right? Like there's four henchmen for divorce.
No, what are they?
That work? Yeah. Most people do want to know that, right? What's the number? Better than 50% of people end up in divorce. And the Gottman Institute found that there's some predictability about
who would divorce within 2 years. Isn't contempt like the number one predictor?
Well, it's yes, but there's four things that go in line. Like, okay, so critique, then defensiveness, then stonewalling, than contempt.
Ah.
So if you display contempt, it's because those other three were in place so long, for such a long amount of time, you're like, contempt is, I hate you, you know, like in whatever.
And you know,
people have, I'm not saying I haven't been there before. It's not the brightest side of me, you know, but it's really this response to critique, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And so if you can hear the person in the back of the room as not a critique, but an interesting perspective, and they might not have the most eloquent way to say it because they are anxious or frustrated or scared or righteous and narcissistic, whatever. But if you can attune to it to be information and not an attack, it opens up a whole nother level of like, where might they be coming from to pick up on that? And if you can entertain that as opposed to, I am being attacked, and it's more an exploratory concept around the idea, It's really fun.
I want to go back to the performance thing for a second, because I think there's a point for people who are not in sports that to me, what I've taken from my interactions with people like you and these different organizations, I think to me the lesson is, if sports, an entire industry about elite performance in high pressure, you know, constrained rule-based situations, are not investing or have historically underinvested in performance, and are just now discovering the benefits of things, as you said, like recovery or mental well-being, dealing with your emotional issues, you know, what's holding you back, etc. If they're just investing in it, how underinvested do you think you probably are in your business, in your industry, or in your life, where there's probably less money on the line, the stakes are less public, and the outcomes are much less binary, so it's harder to even tell what's working or not working?
Yeah, it's the right question for people of influence, whether it's in their home or it's in their business, is we are definitely in the game of relationships. And it starts first with the relationship you have with yourself. I don't think you can outperform your self-esteem. I don't think that that's possible. I think you might get lucky, right?
And sure.
And we should double click on that in a moment, because it's a bit controversial what I just said, controversial. But when it comes to like real human performance, I'm not talking about money and recognition, big car, big watch. I'm talking about purposeful, meaningful way of living, you know, that level of success. Like if your self-esteem, which is like, hey, I don't really think I matter. I don't think you can outperform and have an amazing life if your self-esteem is busted.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
If you don't think you can do something, you're not going to be able to do it. I mean, it's as simple as that.
I'm glad you went there. I'm going a different direction. I'm saying from a foundational place of knowing that your life matters and sure. You matter and it's meaningful to you. Like, and then you add, so that's, let's call it happiness and joy and content and peace. I'm talking about that being the big driver sure. for life performance. And if you want to add on top of it, like extraordinary expressions, to your point, we need then self-confidence. Like, hey, I think I can do that thing. That's self-confidence. Like, it's not, I can do that. You know, it's like, I think I can get my arms around that.
Sure.
So confidence is state specific and self-esteem is more global. It's more pervasive. And so I just don't think, let's go back to the family or the business that you're running or the unit that you're running, is that whether it's above the line, that extraordinary performance metrics, or it's below the line, the well-being and the foundations of life, I just don't think that you can really get there in a sustainable way, in a progressively fast way. Maybe if you want to think about like the fast pace of life, I don't think you get there in the most expedient way without bringing people on board that have been there and done it, understand the science, and can share it in translation in, you know, practicable form. But, you know, Ryan, you and I could figure out how to walk from your hometown to New York City. We could figure out how to do it. But you know what I'd say? I bet I'd listen to you, because I think you'd say, hey, Gervais, why don't we call up, you know, Mary, because she's done it 15 times.
Right.
I think she's got a map, you know, like, what do you think? I'd be like, hell yeah. But why don't we do it with psychology? Why not? Because it was born out of the medical model. And the medical model studies the broken dysfunction joints and bones and diseases. And the first science of psychology was born out of that. So that's why in the 80s, you see people tuck their head down, you know, their hat, and they kind of, hope no one sees I'm going into this psychologist's office, and then have the most amazing conversation, and then like worry about what people see out the, as they leave the back door. Psychologists put two doors in, a front door and a back door, so you wouldn't be seen. And we thought that was good. That's such a bad idea. So, but now it's different because there is a science of excellence, and you get the extraordinaries across multiple disciplines raising their hand to say, hey, my mind's important. Let's go. I'm not leaving up to chance.
I'm so glad you said this, because that's what I meant about sort of my experiences at some of these teams actually has helped me at an individual level, like at the family level. You said, like with my first son, we just could not get him to sleep. He did not sleep at all. He hated sleep. And so for like 2 years, my wife and I just did not sleep. Mostly I would say my wife did not sleep, but to be perfectly honest, but with my second, we sat down and we went, there must be someone who's really good at this thing. And now look, this goes to what we were talking about historically. Like historically, this is what your grandmother would have helped you, or, you know, your aunt, because this would have been more of a community. You're passing wisdom to generation and generation. But that's not how the world is set up for most families these days. So we hired this woman, and it wasn't cheap. So I accept that there's a certain amount of privilege in this, but we hired this person, and she came in, and it totally changed our lives, and it changed our son's life. And now we have this skill set to do this thing that we couldn't do before. And that came from going like, hey, you don't have to learn these things by trial and error. You should ask the person, as you said, who's done it 15 times, or the specialist. You don't have, like, if the woman had given us horrible advice, we would have just ignored it. But it starts with the willingness to take the consult or to ask the question, because you never know what you might get out of it.
Well, therein goes back to our first order of business, is like basic frameworks. Are you a learner or the doomed expert? You know, are you curious or are you a know-it-all? You know, like those are basic philosophical positions. And it's interesting because most people, and I'm going to say 99%, just because it's going to be outrageous when I say it, is that I don't know anyone that thinks that they are not a learner, that thinks that they are closed-minded, that thinks that they are the cause of suffering in the world, that they're the jerk. Like it's always the others, you know?
Yeah, and, sure.
But when you really take a look at how are you investing in learning, you know, and psychology is one of the greatest, beautiful disciplines because you carry it everywhere you go. The complicated nature of it is it's invisible. And the second complication is that because you have a mind, you think that you're sophisticated in the mind. and I'm going to say that's not the case for me. I had to study the bleep out of it to get, you know, just a basic understanding. So I think that, man, it's such a gift that you can give your people that you love. Like, hey, let's get better on how the primary filter of life is your mind, the way that you express yourself and receive information. Let's get that thing. Let's kind of work around some bugs and patches and some holes in the screen. Like, let's get that thing rock solid. And it's just, that's why I'm bullish. I think the next decade, Ryan, is the decade of the mind.
Yeah.
2020 showed us that we came up short.
I agree. And that we're capable of extraordinary things when we concentrate on a problem that previously we said was going to take 10 or 15 years to develop, that actually, in the way that, hey, we're going to put a person on the moon, and then we did that thing, that goes to the self-confidence you're talking about. You're like, oh, it is possible.
It is possible. Yeah. So that's like, I said earlier, you can't outperform your self-esteem. And I'm talking about true performance in life, independent of like the craft.
Right.
And then to your point, like this get to the moon thing, I'm not sure you can outperform your vision either. So vision is like where you really start to believe that thing is possible. And most people can do the intellectual exercise of thinking about all possible radical things. But then as soon as they put that piece of paper away, they're right back to the original framework, which is like, yeah, but, and I don't know, I don't have time for, and, you know, and then they get caught in taking the real risks to invest time or money or energy into the growth capabilities. And so again, this is the slippery nature of psychology, is that most people say one thing, but then like, I'll give you an example. I ask people when I'll do like a keynote type thing, I'll say, okay, how many people in the audience want to get after it? you know, have this amazing life. And I describe it, and 99% of people raise their hand, because it would be weird if you said you didn't want to have an amazing life. Right. So that, and then afterwards, like, okay, would we all agree here that you've got to take some risks? Cause it's not the safe path to get after it in life. And they're like, yeah. And then sometime later down in the keynote, I'll say, okay, right. Who wants to take a risk and come see how their mind works under pressure? And I've got real tests that I can challenge people with. 1 out of 1,000 people raise their hand.
Cause they'd rather not be embarrassed than do the exact thing they said they want to do.
So their framework, they say their framework is A, get after it, whatever, but their true framework is to manage other people's expectations, to look good rather than grow. And that's where I'm not mad about it. I've got the same things, blind spots that I try to work out now, but I've invested in 25 years. They end up changing. And I'm so glad I'm not working on the same freaking blind spots when I was a 15-year-old kid. God help me.
So if we take that most people are probably underinvested in sort of personal development, the mind, psychology, there is another percentage of the population that I see, I think any author sees, I think anyone who speaks at conferences sees, I imagine you see it in your industry too. There's also the person, and I wonder sort of what your read on these types is, who's, I don't want to say overinvested, but they take it to an extreme where, you know, they've got like 5 gurus, they're reading all the time, they're always studying, they're always on to the next thing. And there's an element when I talk to these people where it's so clear they've taken to the investment in this thing as a substitute for taking risks, like you were saying, but also just trusting themselves, like trusting their intuition to like make the decision. Like, for instance, like I sometimes, when you talk to people who are really into like mental models, which you know what they are, I'm studying all these mental models, and then I try to talk to, have you ever actually used this information? Like, do you ever actually think about these models when you make real decisions? It's like, no, because this thing is a distraction. I see the same thing, writers who are really obsessed with tools, right? Like, what program do you use? You know, what kind of paper do you, can get obsessed with these sort of superficial optimizing things at the margin as almost a fleeing from the gritty reality of what you have to do.
I mean, amen, you know, because there's what I've come to learn in the space of high performance, whether it's craft or having a meaningful, purposeful life, is that there are no hacks, there's no shortcuts, there's no tricks and tips. Like, really, there's the fundamental way that you organize your life. And those fundamental decisions pay dividends in informing thoughts, words, and actions. And if you can line those things up, that's what it's about now. Lining up your thoughts, your words, and your actions independent of the external conditions. That's freedom. That is mastery. I can line up my thoughts, words, and actions in the most hostile, rugged, stressful environments because I have a true command of myself. And that is not like, what paper are you using? You know, what is the mental model? It's interesting, but it is the practice, the fundamental practice of expressing, you know, and refining and figuring out how to get better at the things that matter most to you, whether it's loving or communicating or, you know, throwing a football, whatever it might be. And, you know, for some, it's all of that.
I was talking to Rich Roll about this, and we were joking about the irony that people who are really into psychedelics refer to that as doing the work, right? When I'm not saying there's not value in these therapies, and of course, as a psychologist, you know, there's all sorts of medicines that have been totally life-changing for people. So I'm not dismissing it completely, but I think it is interesting to me. There's also this part of, I think, the sort of the world we're in, where people have taken, you know, investing in personal development, mental development, to mean like, go find the one thing that will magically do it for you, as opposed to having a toolkit or a set of practices that cumulatively get you closer to where you want to go.
Yeah, that's it. And I think the getting to where you want to go is always, that's a big word, available right now. And so everything that you need, here's a fundamental axiom I have. Everything you need is already inside you.
I told you that should be the name of your book.
Yeah, I know. Well, we got to figure it out. And so, yeah. And so if that is potentially true and it's worth exploring if it is or not, then our job is to be here now so we can access it, because it's the only place we can access any of our gifts is in the present moment. It's where wisdom is revealed. It's where high performance is expressed. And it's where all things that are amazing are experienced, the present moment. So my mission in life, you know, my purpose, if you will, is to help people live in the present moment more often. And the mission is to show best practices of how to train the mind to be able to do that. And to double click on your earlier comment about people consuming books and being around gurus, like, it's the consumption is the evidence of the anxiety that precedes it. Whether that consumption, whether it comes in the form of like devouring books or it comes in the form of extra reps at work, if it's coming from an anxiety place, it's like, it's just the snake that eats its tail.
Right.
And so undoing that anxiety and applying, to your point, applying the insights and practices is, it's the real challenge. But here's what we know is when you apply something, there's a dip in performance. Any intervention, immediately following the intervention, there's a dip in performance. And if we feel like we're on a tightrope, we can't afford the dip.
Right.
You know, and so that's where it gets, but that's anxiety saying that the rope is really tight. There's slack.
Sure.
You know, there's slack. For most people, there's some slack. And 2019 and 2020 would say that financially, there was less slack for many. And there was less emotional slack too. I mean, anxiety is up, suicide is up, depression is up, you know? So we can't miss that there's real struggle and pain in people's lives that has been unearthed, you know? And so I feel that pain for people. It's incredible what's happening right now. And it's independent of money. You know,
but it also, it also revealed there was more slack, right, than we thought in other ways too, right? It was like, your work was suddenly like, oh yeah, you don't actually have to come into the office. We were lying about that. You can do your job from home, or like you can do your job without business travel or meetings in person, or, you know, make your own hours. So you're right. Like we tend to think, and I got to imagine athletes are like convinced all the time, I'm going to get cut. Coach is going to cut my playing time, etc. But you're probably having to go, no, what matters is that you get this right. There's more slack. The coach would rather you get it right, there'd be a slight dip in performance and then a huge spike of growth, than you to continue at this plateau.
Well, you're right on the tension, is that if you don't believe that you have the or afforded the luxury of making mistakes for that, let's call it the dip, then we end up plateauing.
Right.
And then there's this incredible tension around, why aren't you getting better? Well, how am I supposed to do that without dipping? So, and there's times to employ new interventions, and there's times to kind of stay the course and let it run.
Sure.
And so the last thing we want to do is start tinkering so much the night before game day, or even sometimes the week before the game, you know? So I don't know. I think the human endeavor is amazing. I think it's complicated. I think it's beautiful. And back to the relationship piece is that through relationships, we become, first it begins with yourself, and then it's extended to others. And that includes Mother Nature and, you know, whatever. So it's you are the pebble in the pond. And when you invest in yourself, that ripple becomes a higher magnitude.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. So I was thinking about you and this idea of mastery. I've got to imagine you approach your craft not all that different than a running back or a pitcher would. Like it's something you've dedicated your life to. You're now 25 years in, you're world class at it. You know, you're in an elite level of people who've done it. How do you get better at what you do? Like, how do you think about, am I getting closer to mastery at this thing? Because there's no wins and losses for you.
Yeah, I know. So thank you for the compliment. And the wins and losses are they're a daily function for me now. So here's a framework that I measure success through. So let's call it daily success, is how many times I can get my hair to stand up on edge. And that's called piloerection, technical term. And that just means that I'm so snapped to the awe of an experience that my hair stands up as a reminder, like, ooh, you're in it. So it's that nexus between something that's vast and big and expansive, but the singularity of being fully present with it right in this moment. So that's one way that I'm measuring it, but it's experiential. So that's my scoreboard. That can also, that happens to me mostly in conversations. So it means I'm connecting in some way in the present moment with others, you know, that I really am engaged and interested. I'm listening more now in different ways than I was before. So, you know, being a beginner is harder than it sounds because you got to kind of gate out a bunch of existing frameworks or knowledge points that have been useful in the past, but have a willingness to abandon, you know, things. So that's actually quite tricky to do. And where I go for both of those is that's the reason I started the podcast Finding Mastery, is that if you look at like over the 6 years that we've been doing it, over 300 episodes, is that we've got multiple different domains. And so I'm not going long and deep anymore in one, you know, it's like probably what you're doing as well is like, from this person from this industry is amazing. Let's use the industry to understand how the person works.
Sure.
And then you go across multiples. And so it's like this range that is really fun. And then I'm dipping my toe into your world and trying to write a little bit more, which is, dude, that is hard. I mean, it's just hard, you know, I'm not good at it. And so, but I know that. And so I do my best and have conversations with people like you to say, hey, help me get better.
Well, no, it's a tricky thing with books because usually if you're an expert at whatever it is that you do, you have some sort of medium that you're very effective at communicating it, right? So, you know, maybe you're an entrepreneur, so you speak through making companies, or you're a speaker, so you speak through, you know, on stage, or you speak one-on-one with individual people. You have theories that you've seen play out over and over again. And the tricky thing, and this is what I have to deal with every day, because it's the entirety of my profession, is what's in your head is not what's on the page. And the difference between those two things humbles you and also drives you insane. And so you have to be able to get, like, there's a great writing rule about two crappy pages a day. Like, that's how you write a book. And I think you actually get comfortable. You have to get comfortable not being good at the thing. Because one, it's the only way you can get better. But two, it's never good when you start. It's only, unlike, you know, a home run, it's not a thing you do once. It looks like you read the sentence once, but the sentence might have been read or written 500 times before it came to appear in that form.
It's amazing. I remember when I was a little kid that I was like, why can't people just know what I'm thinking? Like, yes. I had this as a kid, you know, and here I am as a psychologist, like, and God, wouldn't it be awesome if everything that I'm thinking right now was, you know, in a form that I could see too? And neither, so that second part is writing, and the first part is like relationship communication. And it's just really tricky because most people's mind works far faster than they can construct four ideas that hang together in a graph, you know? And there's so much more that I want to say around sentence one and sentence two, but then to reduce it to sentence one and two feels like it takes me too long to get to the essence of it. And so then I just get frustrated and put it down. So I respect what you do, dude, big time.
Well, I very much relate to that feeling because like I've said this before, I sort of came from a family where I didn't really fit in. And so I remember this sort of feeling of like trying to explain something to my parents and the same, like, why don't they get this? Why don't people just know what I'm thinking? And then sort of going back to my room where I had a computer and that was the medium through which I could chat with my friends or write it out or, you know, express it in some way. So it really is, it's a specialty, right? The ability to sort of, Fitzgerald said that, you know, the genius is the ability to take what's in your head and make it real. In writing, it's, can you express thoughts in a compelling, interesting, articulate way? It's not the easiest thing in the world.
And you've done something remarkable is, so I've been in pro sport for a long time. You're in a lot of locker rooms. you know, like your book and your ideas are in most locker rooms. Like it's remarkable because I think you found that sweet spot. Like, okay, I'm not doing the 274 page, whatever, like standard book that no one really reads more sure. than, I don't know, 75 pages, you know, and all the rest is redundant. But like you found that little sweet spot where it's, you can easily kind of hold the book in your hand and it's, you know, it's the old trick in like eighth grade. It's big font. Nice spaces.
No. Yeah, I appreciate that. And it was, I think it comes from what you were just talking about, which is me, like what my frustration with philosophy was, is that people were saying that they were explaining the philosophy instead of illustrating it. And so what was unlocked for me as a writer, and then this is my career, was the decision to say like, oh, you know what? I'm not going to say Marcus Aurelius thought X. I'm going to say, here's someone living by this idea from Marcus Aurelius. I think ultimately humans live by stories. And I think the best books from psychologists, for instance, is never, here's what the research says. It's always starts with a case study and then explains, you know, how this pertains to you. I mean, do I have it here? I mean, this is Man's Search for Meaning. It's the ultimate book of psychology because it's a psychologist where the case study is himself.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the first half of that book is almost like a prerequisite for all humans. Like, it's amazing.
Have you read the new one? It's weird to think he has a new book. But
how can he have a new book?
They found a bunch of lectures that he gave that were lost totally to time. And Daniel Goleman wrote the intro, but it just came out this year. It's called Yes to Life. It's like so good. So good.
Okay. I'll for sure check it. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay.
But cool. What I would do if I were in your shoes is, first off, you would never let someone in your office step into your office and go, I'm just not good at it. You would never let them say that yeah. because it's one of the artificially delimiting beliefs that you were talking about earlier.
But that's accurate. Like I am not good. Like, okay, I'm not trying to compare myself to you. I'm just saying I know that I'm not good at it. And so there's some accuracy in my statement. It's not dinging my self-esteem or confidence, nor is it getting in the way of me putting pen to paper.
But you're identifying with an outcome or a state, a permanent state of being, rather than sort of focusing on like if you were, I would let it go if you were saying like writing is very hard for me, right? That's different than like I'm not good at it. I think what I would just think about in your shoes is like, first off, forget the outcome. Focus on, you know, sort of iterative process. But then I would just go, look, it actually doesn't matter how good the writing is. What matters is how good is the message that's being delivered. And, you know, I've joked about this before, like, you know, Keith Richards' memoir could have been written in crayon and it still would have sold millions of copies because it's an incredible life. You know, I mean, if Man's Search for Meaning was written 40% worse, it would sell 3 million copies instead of 30 million copies, but it would still be a transformative book because it's getting, what matters is that it got to the essence of the human experience. That's not a stylistic choice.
That's cool. Yeah. That's cool. There's space in the way that you're framing it. I appreciate you for that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Hey, let me ask you a quick question before we jump. You know, where do you come from? You know, and I don't mean like your background, but like that place inside of you that is, it's kind of like that feeling behind your eyes. Like when you're at your best. Some people describe it in their chest or their heart. For me, it's kind of, you know, in the upper regions, like where do you come from when you're at your best?
I've been thinking about this a lot. Cause I sort of getting there on my stillness book. I think it's very easy as an ambitious person to come to the earth, whatever you're doing from a place of emptiness. Like if I do this, if I win this, if I make this amount of money, if I appear this place on this bestseller list, that will fill me up. Right. And there is a desperation and a hunger in that that can, and a drive that can create good work. I think, you know, a lot of a lot of great music is done by really hungry, ambitious, you know, like 19-year-olds. Like I might argue Bruce Springsteen's first two records come from that sort of hunger, you know, that Born to Run hunger. But I've tried as I've gotten older and better at it, I realized the best work comes from a place of fullness where you're like, this is what I think. This is what's important to me. This is what I think needs to be said. This is why I'm the person to say it. And if it does well, it does well. And if it doesn't, I still know I did it and it was worth doing. So to me, it's I can come from two places, emptiness or fullness, but fullness is where the best work comes from.
Mm. Not to be lost on mindfulness.
Yes. Know,
like that thought as well. Yeah. So it's interesting you answer it that way because you didn't take it to like, like it comes from an edgy place or it comes from a restlessness or it comes from a place of grace or peace. You're using the word, you're using the framework like empty and full, and you can come from both those places. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a restlessness too. I mean, but that I would argue that you could probably take any of those words and categorize them as either an empty feeling or a full feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think most people come from a scratchiness,
yeah.
You know, this internal unsettled restlessness. And this is why 30% actually suffer from a mental disorder called anxiety. Like 30% meet the clinical criteria. That's a huge number. 15 is the actual data. Yeah. 15 is the actual data, but my best estimate is that that's 50% underreported. So 3 out of 10 people are like clinically struggling with how they use their mind. And the number's much higher when you think about like not meeting the clinical demands, but like, you know, so yeah. So you're thinking about empty and full. It's cool, man. Yeah.
Well, this was amazing, man. I'll let you go. And I appreciate all the work and look forward to chatting again.
Oh, come on, man. Let's go more. Yeah. And thank you for the ways that you've influenced so many people, you know, carrying around your book. I've talked about you and your writings often. And so that's been fun, you know, from a distance to be able to celebrate you and your work and your ideas and to create a renaissance around stoicism is that's no easy task.
Cause well, you called me very early on in the books and you gave me a bunch of very helpful unsolicited advice. And I mean that in a good way, like that you didn't have to do. And, it was very, very helpful and I appreciate it. And it meant a lot.
That's good. Cool, man. Congrats on your pod too.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Ryan. Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.